Well, thanks ever so much for joining us for our Tech Law 10 this week. I'm Jonathan Armstrong, live in the UK, where it looks finally like spring has arrived. And Eric Sinrod, you're with me live from California. Eric.
I'm here in the Bay Area, although it's not so nice outside. Had a rough ferry ride into the office, but spring will come.
Well, excellent. This week, Eric, you've been particularly getting into the meat of this Californian Supreme Court decision on zip codes. We call them postcodes over here in Europe. Tell me more about that.
Yes, there's been a rash of dozens of class action lawsuits in California in the last few weeks in the wake of a California Supreme Court decision called Pineda versus Williams-Sonoma. And in that particular case, which was decided on February 10, the California Supreme Court ruled that a retailer that requires a customer's provision of its mailing zip code along with a credit card transaction potentially is in violation of what we have here called the Song-Beverly Credit Card Act of 1971 in California. And the upshot is that if that's required, the zip code along with the credit card transaction, and one of the exceptions doesn't apply, there can be a penalty of $1,000 per transaction plus attorney's fees. And you can imagine, you know, with a major retailer, $1,000 per transaction plus attorney's fees gets pretty rich fairly fast, and it's attracted plaintiff's attorneys from around the country, from around the state, and they've been filing these class action lawsuits. I should point out, though, this isn't sort of a strict liability situation. There are exceptions. For example, a retailer may record information that's already on the face of the credit card. A retailer may demand reasonable identification but not record the information. This does not apply to internet, telephone, and mail order transactions. Also, if the zip code's required by a contract or by some other law, there can be an exception. But there can be problems. And, you know, one other approach, since these are framed as class actions, whereby, you know, one or two individual plaintiffs say, I'm acting on behalf of many others who are similarly situated, and they're seeking, you know, large relief across a wide swath of people, you know, one approach on the defense side, not only, you know, A, saying, look, we don't actually ask for this information, that's a very strong defense. B, we fit into one of the exceptions that I just outlined. Or C, they can try to defeat the class by saying, look, these different plaintiffs are not similarly situated. They're in different circumstances. This thing cannot move forward on a class action basis. And if that argument prevails, then the class fails and, you know, the lawsuit essentially goes away because it's not worth bringing such a case on behalf of just one person on one credit card transaction. So, Jonathan, I'm interested in your take on this. Obviously, you're not here in California, but you're there in London, and you're dealing with issues across the pond. Maybe you have questions for me on this particular regime, or you can tell us what's happening.
Yeah, no, I definitely do. I mean, it seems to me it's relatively common. Whenever I'm shopping in the U.S., I'm nearly always asked for my zip code, I think, or I mean, maybe the majority of the time I am. And it obviously always puzzles them that I give a UK zip code and they say it doesn't go into their system the majority of the time, and then they apologize and tell me to forget it. So it seems fairly routine, isn't it, for some retailers just to ask for the zip code. And you're telling me that's been unlawful in California for, what, 40 years?
Well, I'm not sure I can say that. I mean, we have a Supreme Court case that just came down less than a month ago, and it was the Supreme Court that basically said, okay, you know, under this particular statute, we're now interpreting it to mean if a retailer requires a zip code along with a credit card transaction and one of these exceptions doesn't apply, yeah, there's liability under the statute. And that's why the lawsuits are now coming out of the woodwork now, because the Supreme Court has spoken on the issue. And we didn't have that guidance previously. In fact, I believe there was case law that went the other way before.
But if the Supreme Court have said that and the legislation goes back to the early 1970s, is that potentially, I mean, do you have a statute of limitations there, do you, which would debar some of the older claims? Is that the same with you?
Well, that's an interesting point. And if you look at these recent class actions, they really are referring to relatively new purchase transactions with credit cards and the use of zip codes. So that's quite possible. And you raise an interesting other point. If this really wasn't the legislature's intent, there's nothing stopping the California legislature from changing the law if they think this is unworkable or unfair. And who knows, there could be a push for that by lobbyists. That wouldn't be surprising, would it?
No. And what's the harm then? What do these class actions say the harm is? Are they saying identity theft, exposure to identity theft? Or is it just lawyers looking to make a buck without there being that much harm at all?
Well, that's a good question. The way the Supreme Court interpreted this was to say that, you know, a person's zip code identifies the region where they live, and that's personal information. Is there really harm there? I mean, there can be a legitimate reason why a retailer might want that information. For example, you know, collecting, you know, on a general basis without referring to a specific individual, but across demographics, knowing, you know, where people are who are making purchases, a retailer might decide, you know what, we need to open up a store in such a location. You know, we're getting all these purchases in location A. They have zip codes from location B. Boy, those people from location B might be interested in us having a store there. And it's really not about tracking the individual. It could be much more broad-based than that, if you follow what I'm saying.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Yeah.
So in our brief couple minutes left, why don't you tell us what's happening on the privacy front in terms of litigation where you are?
Well, one of the interesting things that we've just had this week at the European court level is not disconnected in a way. It's been traditional here for insurers and pension providers to take the details of the gender of the person who's applying for the insurance policy or the pension. The reason for that is, generally speaking, women live longer than men, and generally speaking, apparently, I find this incredible, you might not, Eric, women are better drivers than men. They have less accidents. And something like 95% of the dangerous driving convictions for teenagers in the UK are male rather than female. So statistically, it seems that either women are better drivers or they don't get caught when they drive badly. Anyhow, so far so good. And for years and years, maybe as long as your 40 years of your Californian legislation, UK motor insurers have applied that distinction when they're writing policies. So a female driver with an equivalent driving record and of an equivalent age will pay around about 350 sterling less as a teenager, relatively new driver, than a male equivalent. And what the European courts seem to have said this week is that that's discriminatory. Mm-hmm. It applying broad gender rules, they say, offends European law. And it looks like the insurers are going to have to average out the applicable premiums. So, as I say, bad news for female drivers in most of Europe, because they're probably going to have to find ballpark around $500 each a year on the basis of the, if you like, the insurer's over-collection of data and applying rules on the basis of the data that they've collected. So I guess that's roughly similar. We don't have specific legislation, or it's unusual to have specific legislation like yours, but we have these overarching discrimination and data laws, which can sometimes lead to unforeseen consequences as well, I guess. Whether we'll have a class action following from loads of male but careful drivers saying that for years they've been paying higher premiums than females and they're entitled to some money back, who knows? It's generally speaking, class actions aren't as prevalent here as they are there. But maybe that's a watch this space one.
I can see both sides of that argument. I mean, on the one hand, insurers have to assess risk, and that's how they price premiums on policies, and they have to go on historical data for that. So, for example, if somebody's, you know, people who've been long-term cigarette smokers apply for health insurance, you know, likely they're a greater risk for the health insurer than somebody who doesn't smoke, and that would be priced accordingly. And by the same token, if across a wide population, females are better drivers, you can see where the insurer would price it that way. On the other hand, if you're like you or me, and we're just terrific drivers, and we happen to be male, it might feel a little bit discriminatory that we as individuals have to pay more when our own individual driving record across, you know, say I've been driving for 3 decades and pretend I've never had a speeding ticket or an accident. maybe that's even true. I certainly haven't had an accident. My automobile insurance should be priced on my own history, not across a general history of other people. Well, it's now about that time. I suppose we should sign off. Do you want to do the closing here, Jonathan?
Yes, please. Thanks ever so much for listening. I think this has been very interesting. We'll be tracking that legislation with interest with the Williams-Sonoma litigation. And by all means, if you want any more information about that litigation or anything else, do get in touch with us. Eric, why don't you do your email details first?
My email address is ejsinrod, E-J-S-I-N-R-O-D, at DwayneMorris.com. Jonathan?
I'm J.P. Armstrong at DwayneMorris.com. We're both on LinkedIn. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. Do get in touch with us by any of those means. And thank you for tuning in, and hope to speak to you again next week. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.